Random House Audio presents The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest by Stieg Larsson. Translated from the Swedish by Reg Keeland. Read for you by Simon Vance. Part 1. Intermezzo in a Corridor. April 8th to 12th. An estimated 600 women served during the American Civil War. They had signed up, disguised as men. Hollywood has missed a significant chapter of cultural history here. Or is this history ideologically too difficult to deal with? Historians have often struggled to deal with women who do not respect gender distinctions, and nowhere is that distinction more sharply drawn than in the question of armed combat. Even today it can cause controversy having a woman on a typical Swedish moose hunt. But from antiquity to modern times, there are many stories of female warriors, of Amazons. The best known find their way into the history books as warrior queens, rulers as well as leaders. They have been forced to act as any Churchill, Stalin or Roosevelt. Semiramis from Nineveh, who shaped the Assyrian Empire, and Boudicca, who led one of the bloodiest English revolts against the Roman forces of occupation, to cite just two. Boudicca is honoured with a statue on the Thames at Westminster Bridge, opposite Big Ben. Be sure to say hello to her if you happen to pass by. On the other hand, history is reticent about women who were common soldiers, who bore arms, belonged to regiments, and took part in battles on the same terms as men, though hardly a war has been waged without women soldiers in the ranks. Chapter 1. Friday, April 8th. Dr. Jonasson was woken by a nurse 5 minutes before the helicopter was expected to land. It was just before 1:30 in the morning.
What? He said, confused.
Rescue service helicopter coming in. Two patients, an injured man and a younger woman. The woman has gunshot wounds.
All right, Jonasson said wearily.
Although he had slept for only half an hour, he felt groggy. He was on the night shift in the ER at Sahlgrenska Hospital in Göteborg. It had been a strenuous evening. By 12:30, the steady flow of emergency cases had eased off. He had made a round to check on the state of his patients and then gone back to the staff bedroom to try to rest for a while. He was on duty until 6, and seldom got the chance to sleep, even if no emergency patients came in. But this time he had fallen asleep almost as soon as he turned out the light. Jonasson saw lightning out over the sea. He knew that the helicopter was coming in the nick of time. All of a sudden a heavy downpour lashed at the window. The storm had moved in over Göteborg. He heard the sound of the chopper and watched as it banked through the storm squalls down towards the helipad. For a second he held his breath when the pilot seemed to have difficulty controlling the aircraft. Then it vanished from his field of vision and he heard the engine slowing to land. He took a hasty swallow of his tea and set down the cup. Jonasson met the emergency team in the admissions area. The other doctor on duty took on the first patient who was wheeled in, an elderly man with his head bandaged, apparently with a serious wound to the face. Jonasson was left with the second patient, the woman who had been shot. He did a quick visual examination. It looked like she was a teenager, very dirty and bloody and severely wounded. He lifted the blanket that the rescue service had wrapped around her body and saw that the wounds to her hip and shoulder were bandaged with duct tape, which he considered a very clever idea. The tape kept bacteria out and blood in. One bullet had entered her hip and gone straight through the muscle tissue. He gently raised her shoulder and located the entry wound in her back. There was no exit wound. The round was still inside her shoulder. He hoped it had not penetrated her lung, and since he did not see any blood in the woman's mouth, he concluded that probably it had not. Radiology, he told the nurse in attendance. That was all he needed to say. Then he cut away the bandage that the emergency team had wrapped around her skull. He froze when he saw another entry wound. The woman had been shot in the head, and there was no exit wound there, either. Jonasson paused for a second, looking down at the girl. He felt dejected. He often described his job as being like that of a goalkeeper. Every day people came to his place of work in varying conditions, but with one objective, to get help. Jonasson was the goalkeeper who stood between the patient
and Fonus Funeral Service. His job was to decide what to do. If he made the wrong decision, the patient might die, or perhaps wake up disabled for life. Most often he made the right decision because the vast majority of injured people had an obvious and specific problem. A stab wound to the lung, or a crushing injury after a car crash, were both particular and recognizable problems that could be dealt with. The survival of the patient depended on the extent of the damage and on Jonasson's skill. There were two kinds of injury that he hated. One was a serious burn case, because no matter what measures he took, the burns would almost inevitably result in a lifetime of suffering. The second was an injury to the brain. The girl on the gurney could live with a piece of lead in her hip and a piece of lead in her shoulder, but a piece of lead inside her brain was a trauma of a wholly different magnitude. He was suddenly aware of his nurse saying something.
"Sorry, I wasn't listening."
"It's her."
"What do you mean?"
"It's Lisbeth Salander. The girl they've been hunting for the past few weeks for the triple murder in Stockholm."
Jonasson looked again at the unconscious patient's face. He realized at once that the nurse was right. He and the whole of Sweden had seen Salander's passport photograph on billboards outside every newspaper kiosk for weeks. And now the murderer herself had been shot, which was surely poetic justice of a sort. But that was not his concern. His job was to save his patient's life, irrespective of whether she was a triple murderer or a Nobel Prize winner. Or both. Then the efficient chaos, the same in every ER the world over, erupted. The staff on Jonasson's shift set about their appointed tasks. Salander's clothes were cut away. A nurse reported on her blood pressure, 100/70, while the doctor put his stethoscope to her chest and listened to her heartbeat. It was surprisingly regular, but her breathing was not quite normal. Jonasson did not hesitate to classify Salander's condition as critical. The wounds in her shoulder and hip could wait until later, with a compress on each, or even with the duct tape that some inspired soul had applied. What mattered was her head. Jonasson ordered tomography with a new and improved CT scanner that the hospital had lately acquired. Jonasson had a view of medicine that was at times unorthodox. He thought doctors often drew conclusions that they could not substantiate. This meant that they gave up far too easily. Alternatively, they spent too much time at the acute stage trying to work out exactly what was wrong with the patient so as to decide on the right treatment. This was correct procedure, of course. The problem was that the patient was in danger of dying while the doctor was still doing his thinking. But Jonasson had never before had a patient with a bullet in her skull. Most likely he would need a brain surgeon. He had all the theoretical knowledge required to make an incursion into the brain, but he did not by any means consider himself a brain surgeon. He felt inadequate, but all of a sudden he realized that he might be luckier than he deserved. Before he scrubbed up and put on his operating clothes, he sent for the nurse.
"There's an American professor from Boston working at the Karolinska Hospital in Stockholm. He happens to be in Göteborg tonight, staying at the Elite Park Avenue on Avenyn. He just gave a lecture on brain research. He's a good friend of mine. Could you get the number?"
While Jonasson was still waiting for the X-rays, the nurse came back with a number of the Elite Park Avenue. Jonasson picked up the phone. The night porter at the Elite Park Avenue was very reluctant to wake a guest at that time of night, and Jonasson had to come up with a few choice phrases about the critical nature of the situation before his call was put through.
"Good morning, Frank," Jonasson said when the call was finally answered. "It's Anders. Do you feel like coming over to Sahlgrenska to help out in a brain op?"
"Are you bullshitting me?"
Dr. Frank Ellis had lived in Sweden for many years and was fluent in Swedish, albeit with an American accent, but when Jonasson spoke to him in Swedish, Ellis always replied in his mother tongue.
"The patient is in her mid-twenties. Entry wound, no exit."
"And she's alive?"
"Weak, but regular pulse. Less regular breathing. Blood pressure 100/70. She also has a bullet wound in her shoulder and another in her hip, but I know how to handle those two."
"Sounds promising," Ellis said.
"Promising?
If somebody has a bullet in their head and they're still alive, that points to hopeful."
"I understand. Frank, can you help me out?"
"I spent the evening in the company of good friends, Anders. I got to bed at 1, and no doubt I have an impressive blood alcohol content."
"I'll make the decisions and do the surgery.
but I need somebody to tell me if I'm doing anything stupid. Even a falling-down drunk Professor Ellis is several classes better than I could ever be when it comes to assessing brain damage.
Okay, I'll come, but you're going to owe me one.
I'll have a taxi waiting outside by the time you get down to the lobby. The driver will know where to drop you, and a nurse will be there to meet you and get you scrubbed in.
I had a patient a number of years ago in Boston. I wrote about the case in the New England Journal of Medicine. It was a girl the same age as your patient here. She was walking to the university when someone shot her with a crossbow. The arrow entered at the outside edge of her left eyebrow and went straight through her head, exiting from almost the middle of the back of her neck.
And she survived?
She looked like nothing on earth when she came in. We cut off the arrow shaft and put her head in a CT scanner. The arrow went straight through her brain. By all known reckoning, she should have been dead, or at least suffered such massive trauma that she would have been in a coma.
And what was her condition?
She was conscious the whole time. Not only that, she was terribly frightened, of course. But she was completely rational. Her only problem was that she had an arrow through her skull.
What did you do?
Well, I got the forceps and pulled out the arrow and bandaged the wounds, more or less.
And she lived to tell the tale?
Obviously her condition was critical, but the fact is we could have sent her home the same day. I've seldom had a healthier patient.
Jonathan wondered whether Ellis was pulling his leg.
On the other hand, Ellis went on, I had a 42-year-old patient in Stockholm some years ago who banged his head on a windowsill. He began to feel sick immediately and was taken by ambulance to the ER. When I got to him, he was unconscious. He had a small bump and a very slight bruise, but he never regained consciousness and died after 9 days in intensive care. To this day, I have no idea why he died. In the autopsy report, we wrote brain hemorrhage resulting from an accident, but not one of us was satisfied with that assessment. The bleeding was so minor and located in an area that shouldn't have affected anything else at all. And yet his liver, kidneys, heart, and lungs shut down one after the other. The older I get, the more I think it's like a game of roulette. I don't believe we'll ever figure out precisely how the brain works.
He tapped on the X-ray with a pen.
What do you intend to do?
I was hoping you would tell me.
Let's hear your diagnosis.
Well, first of all, it seems to be a small-caliber bullet. It entered at the temple and then stopped about 4 centimeters into the brain. It's resting against the lateral ventricle. There's bleeding there.
How will you proceed?
To use your terminology, get some forceps and extract the bullet by the same route it went in.
Excellent idea. I would use the thinnest forceps you have.
It's that simple.
What else can we do in this case? We could leave the bullet where it is and she might live to be 100, but it's also a risk. She might develop epilepsy, migraines, all sorts of complaints. And one thing you really don't want to do is drill into her skull and then operate a year from now when the wound itself has healed. The bullet is located away from the major blood vessels, so I would recommend that you extract it, but...
But what?
The bullet doesn't worry me so much. She's survived this far, and that's a good omen for her getting through having the bullet removed, too. The real problem is here.
He pointed at the X-ray.
Around the entry wound you have all sorts of bone fragments. I can see at least a dozen that are a couple of millimeters long. Some are embedded in the brain tissue. That's what could kill her if you're not careful.
Isn't that part of the brain associated with numbers and mathematical capacity? Jonathan said.
Ellis shrugged.
Mumbo jumbo. I have no idea what these particular gray cells are for. You can only do your best. You operate. I'll look over your shoulder.
Mikhail Blomqvist looked up at the clock and saw that it was just after 3 in the morning. He was handcuffed and increasingly uncomfortable. He closed his eyes for a moment. He was dead tired but running on adrenaline. He opened them again and gave the policeman an angry glare. Inspector Thomas Paulson had a shocked expression on his face. They were sitting at a kitchen table in a white farmhouse called Gosseberger, somewhere near Nossebro. Blomqvist had heard of the place for the first time less than 12 hours earlier. There was no denying the disaster that had occurred.
"Imbecile," Blomqvist said.
"Now you listen here."
"Imbecile," Blomqvist said again. "I warned you he was dangerous, for Christ's sake. I told you that you would have to handle him like a live grenade.
He's murdered at least 3 people with his bare hands, and he's built like a tank. And you sent a couple of village policemen to arrest him as if he were some Saturday night drunk.
Blomqvist shut his eyes again, wondering what else could go wrong that night.
He had found Lisbeth Salander just after midnight. She was very badly wounded. He had sent for the police and the rescue service. The only thing that had gone right was that he had persuaded them to send a helicopter to take the girl to Sahlgrenska Hospital. He had given them a clear description of her injuries and the bullet wound in her head, and some bright spark at the rescue service got the message. Even so, it had taken over 30 minutes for the Puma from the helicopter unit in Sever to arrive at the farmhouse. Blomqvist had gotten 2 cars out of the barn. He switched on their headlights to illuminate a landing area in the field in front of the house. The helicopter crew and 2 paramedics had proceeded in a routine and professional manner. One of the medics tended to Salander, while the other took care of Alexander Zalachenko, known locally as Carl Axel Bodin. Zalachenko was Salander's father, and her worst enemy. He had tried to kill her, but he had failed. Blomqvist had found him in the woodshed at the farm with a nasty-looking gash, probably from an axe, in his face, and some shattering damage to one of his legs, which Blomqvist did not bother to investigate. While he waited for the helicopter, he did what he could for Salander. He took a clean sheet from a linen cupboard and cut it up to make bandages. The blood had coagulated at the entry wound in her head, and he did not know whether he dared to put a bandage on it or not. In the end, he fixed the fabric very loosely around her head, mostly so that the wound would not be exposed to bacteria or dirt. But he had stopped the bleeding from the wounds in her hip and shoulder in the simplest possible way. He had found a roll of duct tape and had used it to close the wounds. The medics remarked that this, in their experience, was a brand new form of bandage. He had also bathed Salander's face with a wet towel and done his best to wipe off the dirt. He had not gone back to the woodshed to tend to Zalachenko. He honestly did not give a damn about the man. But he did call Erika Berger, editor-in-chief of Millennium magazine, on his mobile, and told her the situation.
"Are you all right?"
Berger asked him.
"I'm okay," Blomqvist said. "Lisbeth is the one who's in real danger."
"That poor girl," Berger said. "I read Bjork's SEPO report this evening. How should I deal with it?"
"I don't have the energy to think that through right now," Blomqvist said.
Security police matters were going to have to wait until the next day, even if the report could help vindicate Lisbeth. As he talked to Berger, he sat on the floor next to the bench and kept a watchful eye on Salander. He had taken off her shoes and her pants so that he could bandage the wound to her hip, and now his hand rested on the pants which he had dropped on the floor next to the bench. There was something in one of the pockets. He pulled out a palm tungsten T3. He frowned and looked long and hard at the handheld computer. When he heard the approaching helicopter, he stuffed it into the inside pocket of his jacket and then went through all her other pockets. He found another set of keys to the apartment in Mosebacher and a passport in the name of Irene Nesser. He put these swiftly into a side pocket of his laptop case. The first patrol car from the station in Trollhättan arrived a few minutes after the helicopter landed. Next to arrive was Inspector Paulson, who took charge immediately. Blomqvist began to explain what had happened. He very soon realized that Paulson was a pompous, rigid drill sergeant type. He did not seem to take in anything that Blomqvist said. It was when Paulson arrived that things really started to go awry. The only thing he seemed capable of grasping was that the badly damaged girl being cared for by the medics on the floor next to the kitchen bench was the triple murderer Lisbeth Salander, and above all it was important that he make the arrest. 3 times Paulson had asked the urgently occupied medical orderly whether the girl could be arrested on the spot. In the end, the orderly stood up and shouted at Paulson to keep the hell out of his way. Paulson had then turned his attention to the wounded man in the woodshed, and Blomqvist heard the inspector report over his radio that Salander had evidently attempted to kill yet another person. By now Blomqvist was so infuriated with Paulson, who had obviously not paid attention to a word he had said, that he yelled at him to call Inspector Bublansky in Stockholm without delay. Blomqvist had even taken out his mobile and offered to dial the number for him, but Paulson was not interested. Blomqvist then made 2 mistakes. First, he patiently but firmly explained that the man who had committed the murders in Stockholm was Ronald Niedermann, who was built like a heavily armed robot and suffered from a disease called congenital analgesia, and who at that moment was sitting in a ditch on the road to Nosobro, tied to a traffic sign. Blomqvist told Paulson exactly where Niedermann was to be found, and urged him to send a platoon armed with automatic weapons to pick him up. Paulson finally asked how Niedermann had come to be in that ditch, and Blomqvist freely admitted that he himself had put him there, and had managed only by holding a gun on him the whole time.
"Assault with a deadly weapon," was Paulson's immediate response.
At this point, Blomqvist should have realized that Paulson was dangerously stupid. He should have called Poblansky himself and asked him to intervene, to bring some clarity to the fog in which Paulson was apparently enveloped. Instead, he made his second mistake. He offered to hand over the weapon he had in his jacket pocket, the Colt 1911 government model that he had found earlier that day at Salander's apartment in Stockholm. It was the weapon he had used to disarm and disable Niedermann. Not a straightforward matter with that giant of a man. After which Paulson swiftly arrested Blomqvist for possession of an illegal weapon. He then ordered his two officers to drive over to the Nosobro Road. They were to find out if there was any truth to Blomqvist's story that a man was sitting in a ditch there tied to a moose crossing sign. If this was the case, the officers were to handcuff the person in question and bring him to the farm in Gossaberga. Blomqvist had objected at once, pointing out that Niedermann was not a man who could be arrested and handcuffed just like that. He was a maniacal killer, for God's sake. When Blomqvist's objections were ignored by Paulson, the exhaustion of the day made him reckless. He told Paulson he was an incompetent fool, and yelled at him that the officers should fucking forget about untying Niedermann until they had called for backup. As a result of this outburst, he was handcuffed and pushed into the back seat of Paulson's car. Cursing, he watched as the policemen drove off in their patrol car. The only glimmer of light in the darkness was that Salander had been carried to the helicopter, which was even now disappearing over the treetops in the direction of Göteborg. Blomqvist felt utterly helpless. He could only hope that she would be given the very best care. She was going to need it, or she would die. Jonasson made two deep incisions all the way down to the cranium and peeled back the skin around the entry wound. He used clamps to secure the opening. An OR nurse inserted a suction tube to remove any blood. Then came the awkward part, when he had to use a drill to enlarge the hole in the skull. The procedure was excruciatingly slow. Finally, he had a hole big enough to gain access to Salander's brain. With infinite care, he inserted a probe into the brain and enlarged the wound channel by a few millimeters. Then he inserted a thinner probe and located the bullet. From the X-ray, he could see that the bullet had turned and was lying at an angle of 45 degrees to the entry channel. He used the probe cautiously to prise at the edge of the bullet, and after a few unsuccessful attempts, he managed to lift it very slightly so that he could turn it in the right direction. Finally, he inserted narrow forceps with serrated jaws. He gripped the base of the bullet, got a good hold on it, then pulled the forceps straight out. The bullet emerged with almost no resistance. He held it up to the light for a few seconds and saw that it appeared intact. Then he dropped it into a bowl. "Swab," he said, and his request was instantly met. He glanced at the ECG, which showed that his patient still had regular heart activity. "Forceps." He pulled down the powerful magnifying glass hanging overhead and focused on the exposed area.
"Careful," Ellis said.
Over the next 45 minutes, Jonasson picked out no fewer than 32 tiny bone chips from around the entry wound. The smallest of these chips could scarcely be seen with the naked eye. As Blomqvist tried in frustration to manoeuvre his mobile out of the breast pocket of his jacket, it proved to be an impossible task with his hands cuffed behind his back, nor was it clear to him how he was going to be able to use it. Several more vehicles containing both uniformed officers and technical personnel arrived at the Gossaberga farm. They were detailed by Paulson to secure forensic evidence in the woodshed and to do a thorough examination of the farmhouse, from which several weapons had already been confiscated. By now, resigned to his futility, Blomqvist had observed their comings and goings from his vantage point in Paulson's vehicle. An hour passed before it dawned on Paulson that his officers had not yet returned from their mission to retrieve Niedermann. He had Blomqvist brought into the kitchen, where he was required once more to provide precise directions to the spot. Blomqvist closed his eyes. He was still in the kitchen with Paulson when the armed response team sent to relieve the first two officers reported back. One had been found dead, with a broken neck. The other was still alive, but he had been savagely beaten. The men had been discovered near a moose crossing sign by the side of the road. Their service weapons and the marked police car were gone. Inspector Paulson had started out with a relatively manageable situation. Now he had a murdered policeman and an armed killer on the run.
"Imbecile," Blomqvist said again.
"It won't help to insult the police."
"That certainly seems to be true in your case. But I'm going to report you for dereliction of duty, and you won't even know what hit you. Before I'm through with you, you're going to be celebrated as the dumbest policeman in Sweden on every newspaper billboard in the country."
The notion of being the object of public ridicule appeared at last to have an effect on Inspector Paulson. His face was lined with anxiety.
"What do you propose?"
"I don't propose. I demand that you call Inspector Bublansky in Stockholm, this minute. His number's in my mobile in my breast pocket." Inspector Modig woke with a start when her mobile rang at the other end of the bedroom. She saw to her dismay that it was just after 4 in the morning. Then she looked at her husband, who was snoring peacefully. He would probably sleep through an artillery barrage. She staggered out of bed, unplugged her mobile from the charger and fumbled for the talk button. Jan Bublansky, she thought. Who else?
"Everything has gone to hell down in Trollhättan," her senior officer said without bothering to greet her or apologize. "The X-2000 to Göteborg leaves at 5:10. Take a taxi."
"What's happened?"
"Blomqvist found Salander, Niedermann and Zalichenko. Got himself arrested for insulting a police officer, resisting arrest, and possession of an illegal weapon. Salander was taken to Sahlgrenska with a bullet in her head. Zalichenko is there too, with an axe wound to his skull. Niedermann got away, and he killed a policeman tonight."
Modig blinked twice, registering how exhausted she felt. Most of all, she wanted to crawl back into bed and take a month's vacation.
"The X-2000 at 5:10. Okay, what do you want me to do?"
"Meet Jerka Holmberg at Central Station. You're to contact an Inspector Thomas Paulson at the Trollhättan Police. He seems to be responsible for much of the mess tonight. Blomqvist described him as an Olympic-class idiot."
"You've talked to Blomqvist?"
"Apparently he's been arrested and cuffed. I managed to persuade Paulson to let me talk to him for a moment. I'm on my way to Kungsholmen right now, and I'll try to work out what's going on. We'll keep in touch by mobile."
Modig looked at the time again. Then she called a taxi and jumped into the shower for a minute. She brushed her teeth, pulled a comb through her hair and dressed in long black pants, a black T-shirt and a grey jacket. She put her police revolver in her shoulder bag and picked out a dark red leather coat. Then she shook enough life into her husband to explain where she was off to and that he had to deal with the kids in the morning. She walked out the front door just as the taxi pulled up. She did not have to search for her colleague, Criminal Inspector Holmberg. She assumed he would be in the restaurant car, and that is where she found him. He had already bought coffee and sandwiches for her. They sat in silence for 5 minutes as they ate their breakfast. Finally, Holmberg pushed his coffee cup aside.
"Maybe I should get some training in some other field," he said.
Sometime after 4 in the morning, Criminal Inspector Marcus Erlander from the Violent Crimes Division of the Göteborg Police arrived in Gossebergen and took over the investigation from the overburdened Paulson. Erlander was a short, round man in his 50s with grey hair. One of the first things he did was to have Blomqvist released from his handcuffs, and then he produced rolls and coffee from a thermos. They sat in the living room for a private conversation.
"I've spoken with Bublansky," Erlander said. "Bubble and I have known each other for many years. We're both sorry that you were subjected to Paulson's rather primitive way of operating."
"He succeeded in getting a policeman killed tonight," Blomqvist said.
Erlander said,
"I knew the man personally. He served in Göteborg before he moved to Trollhättan. He has a 3-year-old daughter."
"I'm sorry. I tried to warn Paulson."
"So I heard. You were quite emphatic, it seems, and that's why you were cuffed. You were the one who exposed that billionaire financier, Venestrom, last year. But Blansky says you're a shameless journalist bastard and an insane investigative reporter, but that you just might know what you're talking about. Can you bring me up to speed? What happened here tonight is the culmination of the murders of two friends of mine in Enschede, Dag Svensson and Mia Johansson, and the murder of a person who was no friend of mine, a lawyer named Björman, also Lisbeth Salander's guardian. Erlander made notes between taking sips of his coffee. As you no doubt know, the police have been looking for Salander since Easter. She was a suspect in all three murders. First of all, you have to realise that Salander is not only not guilty of these murders, she has been a victim in the whole affair.
I haven't had the least connection to the Enschede business, but after everything that was in the media about her, it seems a bit hard to swallow that Salander could be completely innocent.
Nonetheless, that's how it is. She's innocent, period. The killer is Ronald Niedermann, the man who murdered your officer tonight. He works for Carl Axel Bodine.
The Bodine who's in Saul Grenska with an axe in his skull?
The axe isn't still in his head. I assume it was Salander who nailed him. His real name is Alexander Zalachenko, and he's Lisbeth's father. He was a hitman for Russian military intelligence. He defected in the 70s and was then on the books of SEPO until the collapse of the Soviet Union. He's been running his own criminal network ever since.
Erlander scrutinized the man across from him. Blomqvist's face was shiny with sweat, but he looked both frozen and deathly tired. Until now he had sounded perfectly rational. But Paulson, whose opinion had little influence on Erlander, had warned him that Blomqvist had been babbling on about Russian agents and German hitmen. Hardly routine elements in Swedish police work. Blomqvist had apparently reached the point in his story at which Paulson had decided to ignore everything else he might say. But there was one policeman dead and another severely wounded on the road to Nossebro, so Erlander was willing to listen. But he could not keep a trace of incredulity out of his voice.
Okay, a Russian agent.
Blomqvist smiled weakly, only too aware of how odd his story sounded.
A former Russian agent. I can document every one of my claims.
Go on.
Zalachenko was a top spy in the 60s and 70s. He defected and was granted asylum by SEPO. In his old age, he became a gangster. As far as I understand it, it's not a unique situation in the wake of the Soviet Union's collapse.
Okay.
As I said, I don't know exactly what happened here tonight, but Lisbeth tracked down her father, whom she hadn't seen for 15 years. Zalachenko abused her mother so viciously that she spent most of her life in a nursing home. He tried to murder Lisbeth, and through Niedermann was the architect of the murders of Svensson and Johansson. Plus, he was behind the kidnapping of Salander's friend Miriam Wu. You probably heard of boxer Paolo Roberto's title bout in Nykvarn, as a result of which Wu was rescued from certain death.
If Salander hit her father in the head with an axe, she isn't exactly innocent.
She has been shot 3 times. I think we could assume her actions were on some level self-defence. I wonder...
Yes?
She was so covered with dirt, with mud, that her hair was one big lump of dried clay. Her clothes were full of sand, inside and out. It looked as though she might have been buried during the night.
Niedermann is known to have a habit of burying people alive. The police in Södertalje have found 2 graves in the place that's owned by Svavelsjö Motorcycle Club outside Nykvarn.
3... As a matter of fact, they found one more last night. But if Salander was shot and buried, how was she able to climb out and start wandering around with an axe? Whatever went on here tonight, you have to understand that Salander is exceptionally resourceful. I tried to persuade Paulson to bring in a dog unit.
It's on its way now.
Good. Paulson arrested you for insulting a police officer. I will dispute that. I called him an imbecile and an incompetent fool. Under the circumstances, neither of these epithets could be considered wide of the mark.
It's not a wholly inaccurate description. But you were also arrested for possession of an illegal weapon.
I made the mistake of trying to hand over a weapon to him. I don't want to say anything more about that until I talk to my lawyer.
All right, we'll leave it at that. We have more serious issues to discuss. What do you know about this Niedermann?
He's a murderer, and there's something wrong with him. He's well over 6 feet tall and built like a tank. Ask Paolo Roberto, who boxed with him.
He suffers from a disease called congenital analgesia, which means the transmitter substance in his nerve synapses doesn't function. He feels no pain. He's German. He was born in Hamburg, and in his teens he was a skinhead. Right now he's on the run, and he'll be seriously dangerous to anyone he runs into.
Do you have any idea where he might be heading?
No. I only know that I had him neatly trussed, all ready to be arrested, when that idiot from Trollhättan took charge of the situation.
Annika Giannini woke with a start. She saw that it was 5:58 a.m. She had her first client meeting at 8. She turned to look at her husband, Enrico, who was sleeping peacefully and probably would not be awake before 8. She blinked hard a few times and got up to turn on the coffee maker before she took her shower. She dressed in black pants, a white polo shirt, and a muted brick-red jacket. She made 2 slices of toast with cheese, orange marmalade, and a sliced avocado, and carried her breakfast into the living room in time for the 6:30 television news. She took a sip of coffee and had just opened her mouth to take a bite of toast when she heard the headlines. 1 policeman killed and another seriously wounded. Drama last night, as triple murderer Lisbeth Salander is finally captured. At first she could not make any sense of it. Was it Salander who had killed a policeman? The news item was sketchy, but bit by bit she gathered that a man was being sought for the killing. A nationwide alert had gone out for a man in his mid-30s, as yet unnamed. Salander herself was critically injured, and at Sahlgrenska Hospital in Göteborg. Annika switched to the other channel, but she learned nothing more about what had happened. She reached for her mobile and called her brother, Mikael Blomqvist. She only got his voicemail. She felt a small twinge of fear. He had called on his way to Göteborg. He had been tracking Salander, and a murderer who called himself Ronald Niedermann. As it was growing light, an observant police officer found traces of blood on the ground behind the woodshed. A police dog followed the trail to a narrow trench in a clearing in a wood about a quarter of a mile northeast of the farmhouse. Blomqvist went with Inspector Erlander. Grimly they studied the site. Much more blood had obviously been shed in and around the trench. They found a damaged cigarette case that seemed to have been used as a scoop. Erlander put it in an evidence bag and labelled the find. He also gathered samples of blood-soaked clumps of dirt. A uniformed officer drew his attention to a cigarette butt, a filterless Pall Mall, some distance from the hole. This too was saved in an evidence bag and labelled. Blomqvist remembered having seen a pack of Pall Malls on the kitchen counter in Salachenko's house. Erlander glanced up at the lowering rain clouds. The storm that had ravaged Göteborg earlier in the night had obviously passed to the south of the Nossebro area, but it was only a matter of time before the rain came. He instructed one of his men to get a tarpaulin to cover the trench and its immediate surroundings.
"I think you're right," Erlander said to Blomqvist as they walked back to the farmhouse. "An analysis of the blood will probably establish that Salander was shot and buried here, and I'm beginning to expect that we'll find her fingerprints on the cigarette case. Somehow she managed to survive and dig herself out, and somehow get back to the farm and swung an axe into Zalachenko's skull," Blomqvist finished for him. "She can be a moody bitch." "But how on earth did she handle Niedermann?"
Blomqvist shrugged. He was as bewildered as Erlander on that score. Chapter 2. Friday, April 8th. Modig and Holmberg arrived at Göteborg Central Station just after 8 a.m. Boblanski had called to give them new instructions. They could forget about finding a car to take them to Gossaberger. They were to take a taxi to police headquarters on Ernst Fontelsplatz, the seat of the county criminal police in western Gotland. They waited for almost an hour before Inspector Erlander arrived from Gossaberger with Blomqvist. Blomqvist said hello to Modig, having met her before, and shook hands with Holmberg, whom he did not know. One of Erlander's colleagues joined them with an update on the hunt for Niedermann. It was a brief report. "We have a team working under the auspices of the county criminal police. An APB has gone out, of course. The missing patrol car was found in Alingsås early this morning. The trail ends there for the moment. We have to suppose that he switched vehicles, but we've had no report of a car being stolen thereabouts."
"Media?"
Modig asked, with an apologetic glance at Blomqvist.
It's a police killing, and the press is out in force. We'll be holding a press conference at 10.
Does anyone have any information on Lisbeth Salander's condition? Blomqvist said. He felt strangely uninterested in everything to do with the hunt for Niedermann.
She was operated on during the night. They removed a bullet from her head. She hasn't regained consciousness yet.
Is there any prognosis?
As I understand it, we won't know anything until she wakes up. But the surgeon says he has high hopes that she'll survive, barring unforeseen complications.
And Zalichenko?
Who? Erlander's colleague said. He had not yet been brought up to date with all the details.
Carl Axel Bodine.
I see. Yes, he was operated on last night, too. He had a very deep gash across his face and another just below one kneecap. He's in bad shape, but the injuries aren't life-threatening.
Blomqvist absorbed this news.
You look tired, Modig said.
You got that right. I'm into my third day with hardly any sleep.
Believe it or not, he actually slept in the car coming down from Nosebro, Erlander said.
Could you manage to tell us the whole story from the beginning? Holmberg said. It feels to us as though the score between the private investigators and the police investigators is about 3-0.
Blomqvist gave him a wan smile.
That's a line I'd like to hear from Officer Babel.
They made their way to the police cafeteria to have breakfast. Blomqvist spent half an hour explaining, step by step, how he had pieced together the story of Zalichenko. When he had finished, the detectives sat in silence.
There are a few holes in your account,
Holmberg said at last.
That's possible, Blomqvist said.
You didn't say, for example, how you came to be in possession of the top-secret SEPO report on Zalichenko.
I found it yesterday, at Lisbeth Salander's apartment, when I finally worked out where she was. She probably found it in Bjorman's summer cabin.
So you've discovered Salander's hideout? Modig said.
Blomqvist nodded.
And?
You'll have to find out for yourselves where it is. Salander put a lot of effort into establishing a secret address for herself, and I have no intention of revealing its whereabouts. Modig and Holmberg exchanged an anxious look.
Mikhail, this is a murder investigation, Modig said.
You still don't get it, do you?
Lisbeth Salander is in fact innocent, and the police have destroyed her reputation in unprecedented ways. Lesbian Satanist gang. Where the hell do you get this stuff?
Not to mention her being sought in connection with 3 murders she had nothing to do with. If she wants to tell you where she lives, then I'm sure she will.
But there's another gap I don't really understand, Holmberg said. How does Bjorman come into the story in the first place? You say he was the one who started the whole thing by contacting Zalichenko and asking him to kill Salander. Why would he do that?
My guess is that he hired Zalichenko to get rid of Salander. The plan was for her to end up in that warehouse in Nykvarn.
He was her guardian. What motive would he have had to get rid of her?
It's complicated.
I can do complicated.
He had a hell of a good motive. He had done something that Salander knew about. She was a threat to his entire future and well-being.
What had he done?
I think it would be best if you gave Salander a chance to explain the story herself. He looked Holmberg steadily in the eye.
Let me guess, Modig said. Bjorman subjected his ward to some sort of sexual assault.
Blomqvist shrugged and said nothing.
You don't know about the tattoo Bjorman had on his abdomen?
What tattoo? Blomqvist was taken aback.
An amateurish tattoo across his belly with a message that said, I am a sadistic pig, a pervert, and a rapist. We've been wondering what that was about.
Blomqvist burst out laughing.
What's so funny?
I've always wondered what she did to get her revenge.
But listen, I don't want to discuss this for the same reason I've already given. She's the real victim here. She's the one who has to decide what she is willing to tell you. Sorry. He looked almost apologetic.
Rapes should always be reported to the police, Modig said.
I'm with you on that. But this rape took place 2 years ago, and Lisbeth still hasn't talked to the police about it, which means that she doesn't intend to. It doesn't matter how much I disagree with her about the matter. It's her decision. Anyway.
Yes?
She has no good reason to trust the police. The last time she tried explaining what a pig Zalichenko was, she was locked up in a mental hospital.
Richard Ekstrom, The leader of the preliminary investigation had butterflies in his stomach as he asked his team leader, Inspector Bublansky, to take a seat across from him. Ekstrom straightened his glasses and stroked his well-groomed goatee. He felt that the situation was chaotic and ominous. For several weeks they had been hunting Elizabeth Salander. He himself had proclaimed her far and wide to be mentally imbalanced, a dangerous psychopath. He had leaked information that would have backed him up in an upcoming trial. Everything had looked so good. There had been no doubt in his mind that Salander was guilty of three murders. The trial should have been a straightforward matter, a pure media circus with himself at center stage. Then everything had gone haywire, and he found himself with a completely different murderer, and a chaos that seemed to have no end in sight. That bitch, Salander.
"Well, this is a fine mess we've landed in," he said. "What have you come up with this morning?"
"A nationwide APB has been sent out on this Ronald Niederman, but there's no sign of him. At present he's being sought only for the murder of a police officer, but I anticipate we'll have grounds for charging him with the three murders here in Stockholm. Maybe you should call a press conference."
Bublansky added the suggestion of a press conference out of sheer spite. Ekstrom hated press conferences.
"I think we'll hold off on the press conference for the time being," he snapped.
Bublansky had to stop himself from smiling.
"In the first place, this is a matter for the Göteborg police," Ekstrom said.
"Well, we do have Modig and Holmberg on the scene in Göteborg, and we've begun to cooperate."
"We'll hold off on the press conference until we know more," Ekstrom repeated in a brittle tone. "What I want to know is, how certain are you that Niederman really is involved in the murders in Stockholm?"
"My gut feeling? I'm 100% convinced. On the other hand, the case isn't exactly rock solid. We have no witnesses to the murders, and there is no satisfactory forensic evidence. Maga Lundin and Sonny Niemanen of the Svavelshire MC are refusing to say anything. They're claiming they've never heard of Niederman. But he's going to go to prison for the murder of a policeman."
"Precisely," said Ekstrom. "The killing of the officer is the main thing right now. But tell me this, is there anything at all to even suggest that Salander might be involved in some way in the murders? Could she and Niederman have committed the murders together?"
"I very much doubt it. And if I were you, I wouldn't voice that theory in public."
"So how is she involved?"
"This is an intricate story, as Mikael Blomqvist claimed from the very beginning. It revolves around this Zala, Alexander Zalachenko."
Ekstrom flinched at the mention of the name Blomqvist.
"Go on," he said.
"Zala is a Russian hitman, apparently without a grain of conscience, who defected in the 70s, and Lisbeth Salander was unlucky enough to have him as her father. He was sponsored, or supported, by a faction within SEPO that tied it up after any crimes he committed. A police officer attached to SEPO also saw to it that Salander was locked up in a children's psychiatric clinic. She was 12, and had threatened to blow Zalachenko's identity, his alias, his whole cover."
"This is a bit difficult to digest. It's hardly a story we can make public. If I understand the matter correctly, all this stuff about Zalachenko is highly classified."
"Nevertheless, it's the truth. I have documentation."
"May I see it?"
Bublansky pushed across the desk a folder containing a police report dated 1991. Ekstrom surreptitiously scanned the stamp, which indicated that the document was top secret, and the registration number, which he at once identified as belonging to the security police. He leafed rapidly through the 100 or so pages, reading paragraphs here and there. Eventually he put the folder aside.
"We have to try to tone this down so that the situation doesn't get completely out of our control. So Salander was locked up in an asylum because she tried to kill her father, this Zalachenko. And now she's attacked him with an axe. By any interpretation, that would be attempted murder. And she has to be charged with shooting Maga Lundin in Stallarholmen."
"You can arrest whomever you want, but I would tread carefully if I were you."
"There's going to be an enormous scandal if Seppo's involvement gets leaked."
Bublansky shrugged. His job was to investigate crimes, not to clean up after scandals.
"This bastard from Seppo, this Gunnar Bjork, what do you know about his role?"
"He's one of the major players. He's on sick leave for a slipped disc and lives in Smodalaru at present."
"Okay. We'll keep the lid on Seppo's involvement for the time being. The focus right now is to be on the murder of a police officer.
It's going to be hard to keep this under wraps.
What do you mean?
I sent Anderson to bring in Bjork for a formal interrogation. That should be happening...
Boblansky looked at his watch.
Yes, about now.
You what?
I was rather hoping to have the pleasure of driving out to Smodelero myself, but the events surrounding last night's killing took precedence.
I didn't give anyone permission to arrest Bjork.
That's true. But it's not an arrest. I'm just bringing him in for questioning.
Whichever. I don't like it.
Boblansky leaned forward, almost as if to confide in the other man.
Richard, this is how it is. Salander has been subjected to a number of infringements of her rights, starting when she was a child. I do not mean for this to continue on my watch. You have the option to remove me as leader of the investigation, but if you did that, I would be forced to write a harsh memo about the matter.
Ekstrom looked as if he had just swallowed something very sour. Gunnar Bjork, on sick leave from his job as assistant chief of the Immigration Division of the Security Police, opened the door of his summer house in Smodelaru and looked up at the powerfully built blond man with a crew cut who wore a black leather jacket.
I'm looking for Gunnar Bjork.
That's me.
Kurt Anderson, County Criminal Police.
The man held up his ID.
Yes?
You are requested to accompany me to Kungsholmen to assist the police in their investigations into the case involving Lisbeth Salander.
There must be some sort of misunderstanding.
There's no misunderstanding, Anderson said.
You don't understand. I'm a police officer myself. Save yourself making a big mistake. Check it out with your superior officers.
My superior is the one who wants to talk to you.
I have to make a call, and
you can make your call from Kungsholmen.
Bjork felt suddenly resigned. It's happened. I'm going to be arrested. That goddamn fucking Blomqvist. And fucking Salander.
Am I being arrested?
He said.
Not at the moment, but we can arrange for that if you like.
No, of course I'll come with you. Naturally, I'd want to assist my colleagues in the police force.
All right, then, Anderson said, walking into the hallway to keep a close eye on Bjork as he turned off the coffee machine and picked up his coat.
In the late morning it dawned on Blomqvist that his rental car was still at the Gosseberger farm, but he was so exhausted that he did not have the strength or the means to get out there to fetch it, much less drive safely for any distance. Erlander kindly arranged for a crime scene tech to take the car back on his way home. Think of it as compensation for the way you were treated last night. Blomqvist thanked him and took a taxi to City Hotel and Lorenzbergsgarten. He booked in for the night for 800 kroner, and went straight to his room and undressed. He sat naked on the bed and took Salander's palm tungsten T3 from the inside pocket of his jacket, weighing it in his hand. He was still amazed that it had not been confiscated when Paulson frisked him, but Paulson presumably thought it was Blomqvist's own and he had never been formally taken into custody and searched. He thought for a moment and then slipped it into a compartment of his laptop case, where he had also put Salander's DVD marked Bjurman, which Paulson had also missed. He knew that, technically, he was withholding evidence, but these were the things that Salander would no doubt prefer not to have fall into the wrong hands. He turned on his mobile and saw that the battery was low, so he plugged in the charger. He made a call to his sister, Advocate Giannini.
Hi, Annika.
What did you have to do with the policeman's murder last night?
She asked him at once.
He told her succinctly what had happened.
So Salander is in intensive care?
Correct. And we won't know the extent or severity of her injuries until she regains consciousness. But now she's really going to need a lawyer.
Giannini thought for a moment.
Do you think she'd want me for her lawyer?
Probably she wouldn't want any lawyer at all. She isn't the type to ask anyone for help.
Mikhail, I've said this before. It sounds like she might need a criminal lawyer. Let me look at the documentation you have.
Talk to Erika and ask her for a copy.
As soon as Blomqvist hung up, he called Berger himself. She did not answer her mobile, so he tried her number at the Millennium offices. Henry Cortez answered.
Erika's out somewhere, he said.
Blomqvist briefly explained what had happened and asked Cortez to pass the information to Erika.
I will. What do you want us to do?
Cortez said.
Nothing today, Blomqvist said.
I have to get some sleep. I'll be back in Stockholm tomorrow, if nothing else comes up. Millennium will have an opportunity to present its version of the story in the next issue, but that's almost a month away.
He flipped his mobile shut and crawled into bed. He was asleep within 30 seconds. Assistant County Police Chief Karina Spongberg tapped her pen against her glass of water and asked for quiet. 9 people were seated around the conference table in her office at police headquarters. 3 women and 6 men. The head of the Violent Crimes Division and his assistant head. 3 criminal inspectors, including Erlander. The Göteborg Police Public Information Officer. Preliminary Investigation Leader Agneta Järvas from the Prosecutor's Office, and Inspectors Mordig and Holmberg from the Stockholm Police. They were included as a sign of goodwill and to demonstrate that Göteborg wished to cooperate with their colleagues from the capital, possibly also to show them how a real police investigation should be run. Spongberg, who was frequently the lone woman in a male landscape, had a reputation for not wasting time on formalities or mere courtesies. She explained that the county police chief was at the Europol conference in Madrid, that he had cut short his trip as soon as he learned that one of his police officers had been murdered, but that he was not expected back before late that night. Then she turned directly to the head of the Violent Crimes Division, Anders Persson, and asked him to brief the assembled company.
"It's been about 10 hours since our colleague was murdered on Nossebrovägen. We know the name of the killer, Ronald Niedermann, but we still don't have a picture of him. In Stockholm we have a photograph of him that's about 20 years old. Paolo Roberto got it through a boxing club in Germany, but it's almost unusable," Holmberg said.
"All right. The patrol car that Niedermann is thought to have driven away was found in Alingsås this morning. As you all know, it was parked on a side street 1/4 mile from the railway station. We haven't had a report yet of any car thefts in the area this morning.
What's the status of the search?"
"We're keeping an eye on all trains arriving in Stockholm and Malmö. There is a nationwide APB out, and we've alerted the police in Norway and Denmark. Right now we have about 30 officers working directly on the investigation, and of course the whole force is keeping their eyes peeled."
"No leads?"
"No, nothing yet. But someone with Niedermann's distinctive appearance is not going to go unnoticed for long."
"Does anyone know about the wounded officer's condition?" asked one of the inspectors from Violent Crimes.
"He's at Sahlgrenska. His injuries seem to be similar to those of a car crash victim. It's hardly credible that anyone could do such damage with his bare hands. Leg broken, ribs crushed, cervical vertebrae injured. Plus there's a risk that he may be paralysed."
They all took stock of their colleague's plight for a few moments, until Spongberg turned to Erlander.
"Marcus, tell us what really happened at Gossebergen."
"Thomas Paulson happened at Gossebergen."
A ripple of groans greeted this response.
"Can't someone give that man early retirement? He's a walking catastrophe."
"I know all about Paulson," Spongberg interjected, "but I haven't heard any complaints about him in the last... well, not for the past 2 years. In what way has he become harder to handle?"
"The police chief up there is an old friend of Paulson's, and he's probably been trying to protect him. With all good intentions, of course, and I don't mean to criticise him. But last night, Paulson's behaviour was so bizarre that several of his people mentioned it to me."
"In what way bizarre?"
Erlander glanced at Mordig and Holmberg. He was embarrassed to be discussing flaws in their organisation in front of the visitors from Stockholm.
"As far as I'm concerned, the strangest thing was that he detailed one of the techs to make an inventory of everything in the woodshed, where we found the Zalichenko guy."
"An inventory of what in the woodshed?" Spongberg wanted to know.
"He said he needed to know exactly how many pieces of wood were in there, so that the report would be accurate."
There was a charged silence around the conference table before Erlander went on.
"And this morning it came out that Paulson has been taking at least 2 different antidepressants. He should have been on sick leave, but no one knew about his condition."
"What condition?"
Spongberg said sharply.
"Well, obviously I don't know what's wrong with him. Patient confidentiality and all that. But he's been taking both strong tranquilizers and stimulants. He was high as a kite all night."
"Good God!"
said Spongberg, emphatically. She looked like the thundercloud that had swept over Göteborg that morning.
"I want Paulson in here for a chat, right now."
"He collapsed this morning and was admitted to the hospital suffering from exhaustion. It was just our bad luck that he happened to be on rotation."
"Did he arrest Mikael Blomqvist last night?"
He wrote a report citing disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, and illegal possession of a weapon. That's what he put in the report.
What does Blomqvist say?
He concedes that he was insulting, but he claims it was in self-defence. He says that the resistance consisted of a forceful, verbal attempt to prevent two officers from going to pick up Niedermann alone without backup.
Witnesses?
Well, there is the surviving officer. I don't believe Paulson's claim of resisting arrest. It's a typical preemptive retaliation to undermine potential complaints from Blomqvist.
But Blomqvist managed to overpower Niedermann all by himself, did he not? Prosecutor Jervas said.
By holding a gun on him.
So Blomqvist had a gun? Then there was some basis for his arrest after all. Where did he get the weapon?
Blomqvist won't discuss it without his lawyer being there, and Paulson arrested Blomqvist when he was trying to hand in the weapon to the police.
Could I make a small, informal suggestion? Modig said cautiously.
Everyone turned to her.
I have met Mikhail Blomqvist on several occasions in the course of this investigation. I have found him quite likable, even though he is a journalist. I suppose you're the one who has to make the decision about charging him. She looked at Jervas, who nodded. All this stuff about insults and resisting arrest is just nonsense. I assume you will ignore it. Probably. Illegal weapons are more serious.
I would urge you to wait and see. Blomqvist has put the pieces of this puzzle together all by himself. He's way ahead of us on the police force.
It will be to our advantage to stay on good terms with him and ensure his cooperation, rather than unleash him to condemn the entire police force in his magazine and elsewhere in the media.
After a few seconds, Erlander cleared his throat. If Modig dared to stick his neck out, he could do the same.
I agree with Sonia. I too think Blomqvist is a man we could work with. I've apologized to him for the way he was treated last night. He seems ready to let bygones be bygones. Besides, he has integrity. He somehow tracked down where Salander was living, but he won't give us the address. He's not afraid to get into a public scrap with the police, and he's most certainly in a position where his voice will carry just as much weight in the media as any report from Paulson.
But he refuses to give the police any information about Salander.
He says that we'll have to ask her ourselves if that time ever comes. He says he absolutely won't discuss a person who is not only innocent, but who also has had her rights so severely violated.
What kind of weapon is it?
Jervas said.
It's a Colt 1911 Government, serial number unknown. Forensics has it, and we don't know yet whether it is connected to any known crime in Sweden. If it is, that will put the matter in a rather different light.
Spångberg raised her pen.
Agneta? It's up to you to decide whether you want to initiate a preliminary investigation against Blomqvist, but I advise that you wait for the report from forensics. So let's move on. This character Zalachenko, what can our colleagues from Stockholm tell us about him? The truth is, Modig said, that until yesterday afternoon we had never heard of either Zalachenko or Niedermann.
I thought you were busy looking for a lesbian Satanist gang in Stockholm. Was I wrong?
One of the Göteborg detectives said. His colleagues all frowned. Holmberg was studying his fingernails. Modig had to take the question.
Within these four walls, I can tell you that we have our equivalent of Inspector Paulson, and all that stuff about a lesbian Satanist gang is probably a smokescreen, originating mainly from him.
Modig and Holmberg then described in detail the investigation as it had developed. When they had finished, there was a long silence around the table.
If all this about Gunnar Bjork is true and it comes out, Seppo's ears are going to be burning.
The assistant head of the Violent Crimes Division concluded. Jervas raised her hand.
It sounds to me as though your suspicions are for the most part based on assumptions and circumstantial evidence. As a prosecutor, I would be uneasy about the lack of unassailable evidence.
We're aware of that, Holmberg said. We think we know what happened in general, but there are questions that still have to be answered.
I gather you're still busy with excavations in Nykvarn, Spångberg said. How many killings do you reckon this case involves?
Holmberg rubbed his eyes wearily.
We started with two, then three murders in Stockholm. Those are the ones that prompted the hunt for Salander. The deaths of Advocate Bjurman, the journalist Dag Svensson, and Mia Johansson, an academic. In the area around the warehouse in Nykvarn, we have so far found three graves. Well, three bodies. We've identified a known dealer and petty thief who was found dismembered in one trench. We found a woman's body in a second trench. She's still unidentified, and we haven't dug up the third yet. It appears to be older than the others.
Furthermore, Blomqvist has made a connection to the murder several months ago of a prostitute in Södertälje. So, with a policeman dead in Gossaberga, we're talking about at least 8 murders. That's a horrendous statistic. Do we suspect this Niedermann of all of them? If so, he has to be treated as a madman, a mass murderer.
Modig and Holmberg exchanged glances. It was now a matter of how far they wanted to align themselves with such assertions. Finally, Modig spoke up.
Even though crucial evidence is lacking, my superior, Inspector Bublansky, and I are tending towards the belief that Blomqvist is correct in claiming that the first 3 murders were committed by Niedermann. That would require us to believe that Salander is innocent. With respect to the graves in Nykvarn, Niedermann is linked to the site through the kidnapping of Salander's friend Miriam Wu. There is a strong likelihood that she too would have been his victim. But the warehouse is owned by a relative of the president of Svavelsjö Motorcycle Club, and until we're able to identify the remains, we won't be able to draw any conclusions. That petty thief you identified, 44, a dealer and delinquent in his youth. Offhand, I would guess the murder has to do with an internal shake-up of some sort. Svavelsjö MC is mixed up in several kinds of criminal activity, including the distribution of methamphetamine. Nykvarn may be a cemetery in the woods for people who crossed them, but... Yes? This young prostitute who was murdered in Södertälje. The autopsy revealed that she died as a result of a staggeringly vicious assault. She looked as if she had been beaten to death, but the actual cause of her injuries could not be established. Blomqvist made a pretty acute observation. She had injuries that could very well have been inflicted by a man's bare hands. Niedermann? It's a reasonable assumption, but there's no proof yet. So how do we proceed? Spongberg wondered. I have to confer with Bublansky, Modig said, but a logical step would be to interrogate Zalachenko. We're interested in hearing what he has to say about the murders in Stockholm, and for you it's a matter of finding out what was Niedermann's role in Zalachenko's business. He might even be able to point you in the direction of Niedermann.
One of the detectives from Göteborg said, What have you found at the farm in Gossaberga?
We found 4 revolvers, a Sig Sauer that had been dismantled and was being oiled on the kitchen table, a Polish P-83 Vanat on the floor next to the bench in the kitchen, a Colt 1911 Government, that's the pistol that Blomqvist tried to hand in to Paulson, and finally a .22 caliber Browning, which is pretty much a toy gun alongside the others. We rather think that it was the weapon used to shoot Salander, given that she's still alive with a slug in her brain. Anything else? We found and confiscated a bag containing about 200,000 kroner. It was in an upstairs room used by Niedermann. How do you know it was his room? Well, he does wear a size XXL. Zalachenko is at most a medium.
Do you have anything on Zalachenko or Bodine in your records?
Holmberg said. Erlander shook his head.
Of course, it depends on how we interpret the confiscated weapons. Apart from the more sophisticated weaponry and an unusually high-tech video surveillance system at the farm, we found nothing to distinguish it from any other farmhouse. The house itself is Spartan. No frills.
Just before noon there was a knock on the door and a uniformed officer delivered a document to Spongberg.
We've received a call, she said, about a missing person in Arlingsås. A dental hygienist by the name of Anita Kaspersen left her home by car at 7:30 this morning. She took her child to daycare and should have arrived at her place of work by 8, but she never did. The dental office is about 150 yards from the spot where the patrol car was found.
Erlander and Modig both looked at their wristwatches.
Then he has a 4-hour head start. What kind of car is it?
A dark blue 1991 Renault. Here's the registration number.
Send out an APB on the vehicle at once. He could be in Oslo by now. Or Malmö. Or maybe even Stockholm.
They brought the conference to a close by deciding that Modig and Erlander would together interrogate Zalachenko. Cortez frowned and followed Berger with his gaze as she cut across the hall from her office to the kitchenette. She emerged moments later with a cup of coffee, went back into her office and closed the door. Cortez could not put his finger on what was wrong. Millennium was the kind of small office where co-workers were close. He had worked part-time at the magazine for 4 years, and during that time the team had weathered some phenomenal storms, especially during the period when Blomqvist was serving a 3-month sentence for libel and the magazine almost went under. Then their colleague, Dag Svensson, was murdered, and his girlfriend, too.
Through all these storms, Berger had been the rock that nothing seemed capable of shifting. It was not surprised that she had called to wake him early that morning and put him and Lotta Karim to work. The Salander affair had cracked wide open, and Blomqvist had somehow gotten himself involved in the killing of a policeman in Göteborg. So far, everything was under control. Karim had parked herself at police headquarters and was doing her best to get some solid information out of someone. Cortez had spent the morning making calls, piecing together what had happened overnight. Blomqvist was not answering his phone, but from a number of sources, Cortez had a fairly clear picture of the events of the night before. Berger, on the other hand, had been distracted all morning. It was rare for her to close the door to her office. That usually happened only when she had a visitor, or was working intently on some problem. This morning she had not had a single visitor, and she was not, so far as he could judge, working. On several occasions, when he had knocked on the door to relay some news, he had found her sitting in the chair by the window. She seemed lost in thought as she listlessly watched the stream of people walking down below on Gurtgarten. She had paid scant attention to his reports. Something was wrong. The doorbell interrupted his ruminations. He went to open it and found the lawyer Annika Giannini. Cortez had met Blomqvist's sister a few times, but he did not know her well.
"Hello, Annika," he said. "Mikael isn't here today." "I know. I want to talk to Erika."
Berger barely looked up from her position by the window, but she quickly pulled herself together when she saw who it was.
"Hello," she said. "Mikael isn't here today."
Giannini smiled.
"I know. I'm here for Björk's Seppo report. Mika asked me to take a look at it in case it turns out that I represent Salander."
Berger nodded. She got up, took a folder from her desk, and handed it to Giannini. Giannini hesitated a moment, wondering whether to leave the office. Then she made up her mind and, uninvited, sat down across from Berger.
"Okay. What's going on with you?" "I'm about to resign from Millennium, and I haven't been able to tell Mikael. He's been so tied up in the Salander mess that there hasn't been the right opportunity, and I can't tell the others before I tell him. Right now, I just feel like shit."
Giannini bit her lower lip.
"So you're telling me instead?"
"Why are you leaving?"
"I'm going to be editor-in-chief of Svenska Morgenposten."
"Jesus."
"Well, in that case, congratulations seem to be in order rather than any weeping or gnashing of teeth." "Annika, this isn't the way I had planned to end my time at Millennium, in the middle of chaos. But the offer came like a bolt from the blue, and I can't say no. I mean, it's the chance of a lifetime. I got the offer just before Dag and Mia were shot, and there's been such turmoil here that I buried it. And now I have the world's worst guilty conscience."
"I understand. But now you're afraid of telling Mika."
"It's an utter disaster. I haven't told anybody. I thought I wouldn't be starting at SMP until after the summer, and that there would still be time to tell everyone. But now they want me to start ASAP.
She fell silent and stared at Annika. She looked on the verge of tears.
"This is, in point of fact, my last week at Millennium. Next week I'll be on a trip, and then I need about 2 weeks off to recharge my batteries. I start at SMP on the 1st of May." "Well, what would have happened if you'd been run over by a bus? Then they would have been without an editor-in-chief with only a moment's notice."
Erika looked up.
"But I haven't been run over by a bus. I've been deliberately keeping quiet about my decision."
"I can see this is a difficult situation, but I have a feeling that Mika and Krista Malm and the others will be able to work things out. I think you ought to tell them right away."
"All right. But your damned brother is in Göteborg today. He's asleep and has turned off his mobile."
"I know. There aren't many people who are as stubborn as Mikael about not being available when you need him.
But, Erika, this isn't about you and Mika. I know that you've worked together for 20 years or so, and you've had your ups and downs, but you have to think about Krista and the others on the staff, too. I've been keeping it under wraps all this time. Mika's going to go through the roof, of course he is. But if he can't handle the fact that you screwed up one time in 20 years, then he isn't worth the time you've put in for him."
Berger sighed.
"Pull yourself together," Giannini told her. "Call Krista in and the rest of the staff. Right now."